try to throw all of this over the table. You're talking about the political stakes involved in the revolution for President Carter.
I recognized by that time that one had to suggest the political stakes involved, that there was little point in approaching the president on the basis of realpolitik or the strategic interests of the United States or the geopolitical role of the Shah or anything of that sort, and that the way to affect the president was to deal with his domestic base by dealing with those advisors who were closest to him. So I talked to Jordan, I talked to Charlie Curbo. I thought Curbo could best be moved on the political issue. He could not be. First of all, nobody has less of a sense of international politics than Curbo. But moreover, he was totally convinced that the position of the president was politically impregnable and that nothing could could occur to damage it. That was his long-term view. Jordan was very sympathetic, and Jordan promised to go and speak to the president. He kept making that promise on and off because he was a great procrastinator until the middle of December, by which time it was getting very late in the game.
Did you personally ever approach President Carter with your plan for a special representative?
Well, yes, indeed, I did do that, and I can come to that later on. First, you better deal with the ball issue.
One plan that did come up by George Ball for a Council of Notables, which I think he recommended in mid-December 78. How did you assess that plan?
Well, I had seen a fair amount of Ball. He was introduced towards the end of November into these discussions, or mid-November. Brzezinski said that he had brought him in. Blumenthal said that he had brought him in. I don't know just what the origins lay, but he was to do a study for the president. And at the time, I thought less of Paul's recommendations than I do today. In retrospect, I think that they were better than I thought at the time. I would say that Ball's views were quite different from mine and Brzezinski's. We thought that any visible attempt of the United States to undercut the Shah would be devastating because it would cut the confidence of the military establishment in U.S. support and in the Shah, and that the military were the critical element in sustaining the regime. I think that is correct, and I've always thought that was correct. Ball's views were quite different. He wanted to ease the Shah out in favor of a Council of Notables. I regarded that then and regard it today as rather academic because the Western-oriented notables with whom we know had no political base in the country to speak of, and that we thought they had a political base because they associated with Americans and spoke pretty good English, but they were relics of the past, basically, and reflected the remnants of the National Front of Mossadegh and the like. There were some eminent people amongst them, but they did not have independent standing in order to control the country. One needed the throne and the army. I don't think there was a full enough appreciation of that. In retrospect, I think less harshly of Ball's views, because we know now what we did not know then, that the Shah was mortally ill. And that the Shah knew that he was mortally ill, and that the Shah might have been persuaded indeed to move aside because of illness and establish a regency. Then you could have used the regency to attempt to broaden the base. But the essential standoff in the country was between the elements of authority represented by the military and the elements of insurrection represented by Khomeini. One had to look at these central features, in my judgment. If you had had a regency in favor of the Crown Prince, you would certainly have wanted to attempt to broaden the base and to take advantage of that shift to bring in other elements that had been alienated by the Shah, the bazaars. I don't think there was much you could do about most of the clergy by that time. They were they were following Khomeini and had the bit between their teeth. But the notion that a council of notables would have sufficient legitimacy to control the country struck me as a weak notion. I am more, and still does, I am more persuaded today that in light of his illness that it would have been a good idea to ease the Shah out and move towards a regency.
You assumed at the time that the military would, in fact, you assumed that the special representative was sent to the Shah, to bark him up, as you said, that he could reinforce his will to impose a respect of the martial law.
I'm not sure that we got that on the tape, did we?
I think that you mentioned that earlier, that the idea was bucking up the Shah.
Well, yeah, I wanted to buck up the Shah, and that I knew that he had felt keenly the ambivalence of the Carter administration, and that he would be wavering given the Shah's nature, and that what we had to do if we were to salvage the throne was to give an unequivocal demonstration of support. And that could come only from people that he knew were solid supporters. I think that it's clear that he did not regard Bill Sullivan in the embassy as a solid supporter. And I urge that, I urge Jordan that not only did we make clear where our stand was, but we do so effectively by sending myself, Walker Jinsky, out there. The reason I felt that I myself would have been appropriate was that I traced back to the Nixon period and I had the longest personal relationship with the Shah. That's why I thought of flying there from Peking. But I urged Jordan and Powell to recognize the importance, as well as others. I had the same conversation with Brzezinski, but I didn't have to spend much time arguing with Brzezinski since he was there before I had gotten to him, but how important it was for us to continue to display fidelity to the throne. And that the best thing to do, I urged Brzezinski as well as Jordan, was to send myself out there or him out there, and Brzezinski carried that to the president. Jordan kept saying that he wanted to talk to the president about these matters in order to convey quietly the political consequences for the president, as they were for him. Being Jordan, he never got around to it because he was a man who devoted himself to one thing at a time. Part of the problem of the American government in that period was that it was so preoccupied with a number of things, including the breakthrough with China, which came more or less concurrently, the SALT negotiations and the like. Cy Vance was totally devoted to the SALT negotiations in that period. And Jordan himself was a sort of a one-issue man, so he just procrastinated towards the middle of December and told me he hadn't gotten around to it and suggested that I go see the president myself. It was very late in the game. I continued to work with Brzezinski on trying to shore up our overall position. So at the end of the month, I suggested that we send the Constellation, I believe, as a carrier without it. Philippines, into the Indian Ocean. And the demonstration of U.S. support, that incidentally was less in terms of intimidating the Shah's opponents in Iran, which was difficult to do or possible to do, and in terms of bucking up the Saudis who were, and others in the region who saw our policy as wobbling. This would be a visible demonstration of U.S. power and concern. Brzezinski agreed to do that, and we attacked that at one of the little NSC committee meetings. We got Cy Vance to go along with that. Somewhat to my surprise, Harold Barham was on these issues, mostly in the middle. The message was sent up to the president at the same time that Harold dispatched the constellation towards the Straits of Malacca with the notion of staying outside of the Straits of Malacca. That worked out just disastrously. If I had ever had any notion that the constellation would go down the Straits of Malacca and then be turned back, I would never have made the suggestion in the first place, because that kind of tended to confirm the image of a wobbling, waffling America that was under no circumstances prepared to use its power. It gave just the opposite demonstration of what we wanted. I wondered what had happened to it. At the time, I had suspected that Vance, during his trip to Camp David, had persuaded the president not to send it. I suspected that Vance was ambivalent, but according to the account of Gary Sick, that was not the problem. The problem was the leak, and that Carter had heard about it, and he was infuriated and turned it around for what I'll call issues of presidential pride that have nothing to do whatsoever with the geopolitical questions in the region.
Now, a minute ago, you mentioned that you had taken your proposal for a special representative to President Carter.
I did indeed. But I've got to say that by the end of the month, by the end of December, I was beginning to despair of the situation in the region. There was talk of the Shah's departure. I went to the president early in January, and we spent some considerable time together. Now, I've got to stress that my relations with Jimmy Carter always, almost invariably, were very good. They were warm. He tended to have a considerable affection for me. We had a good deal of spirited discussion that passed beyond the usual dry conveying of facts. This was true of my experience in many areas, most notably, but not confined to energy discussions. And the reason that I mentioned that was that on that occasion early in January, when I visited with the president, that the relationship was very cold indeed. The encounter was a cold one. I talked to what I expressed as my concern as to the consequences of the fall of the Shah and the critical importance Army, and the president indicated these things are not going to be released until I want them released, are they?
Absolutely.
The president indicated, the president was taken up in one of his bouts of enthusiasm. He talked about the fact that there was great hope. There was great hope because the Shah was now restoring the Constitution of 1906, and because the Marshalist was going to be reassembled, and he indicated that there would be a new premier, and there would be Barzagon, and he stated there would be a new premier. It was kind of impressive at that, as well as in the tables. And that there was great hope as a result of the restoration of constitutionalism in the country. And it struck me, since I had been, as I say, devoting much of my time to this, believed much more in the role of power in such affairs than in the role of constitutionalism, the politics of generosity, or what have you. This struck me as utterly naive. I think I spoke more sharply to the president than was my wont or what he expected. And I said, "Mr. President, that's just kind of American civics. The Constitution of 1906. Has precious little to do with the outcome in the country, that the critical question is the fidelity of the army to the throne, that in my judgment, if the Shah leaves the country and the throne is in danger, Mr. Barzagon is not going to last 6 weeks." And he reacted angrily, though Jimmy Carter gets colder when he gets angry, and his voice can convey disapproval of my message, if not of me. He said, "Yes, I understand that the role of the army is critical, and that is why we're going to send out a representative of the president, as you have suggested." And that the representative of the president will be General Heiser, who will be going there sometime in the near future, maybe the next few days. And I responded sharply again, as is my wont. I never learned the appropriate deference to presidents. I responded quite sharply that General Heiser is a man that I know and admire. He used to work with me, worked during the airlift to Israel. I know him quite well, but General Heiser is just the wrong man to send out there, Mr. President. First place, he is stationed in Europe. He has no connection with you. He is not a personal representative of the President of the United States. He is just a military man. And this will not be taken to be a clear and unequivocal demonstration of American support for the throne. Since he does not represent you, he represents the United States in some more limited sense. Moreover, I said, Dutch Heiser has very limited experience in Iran and relatively limited experience in these kinds of diplomatic matters. And moreover, he very clearly comes from the wrong service, Mr. President. The problem in Iran is that the outcome depends critically on the attitude of the Iranian army. And the Iranian army trusts American army generals, but the Iranian army has been engaged in a conflict with the Iranian Air Force, and Dutch Heiser is an Air Force general, and he will not be able effectively to communicate with army generals. I don't know whether there is an appropriate army general, but I know that an Air Force general is wrong. Well, Carter, about that point, began to get edgy and made clear signs that the discussion and the interview was coming to an end. He said that he disagreed with me and that Heiser was going to go out there and so forth. Before the meeting, I had pretty well made up my mind that if we had reached virtually the end, and that if the president who was planning to depart for the Caribbean had not taken clear and effective action to sustain the throne by the time that he departed for the Caribbean, that you might as well wash your hands of it. That was, I feel in retrospect to be remiss, because I had counted more on Jordan to carry that message for me, which he had promised to do, and that because he procrastinated, that the message had not gotten through in early December, or actually mid-November, when it should have gotten through, and that by the time I actually had been encouraged to go to the president myself, it was really pretty much too late. My view of the matter is that by September, the Shah was in some degree of trouble with the Abadan fire, but there still probably was a 30% chance of saving him. 70% chance of saving him. 30% chance he was going down the tubes. By the time of martial law, that may have slipped to as low as 50-50 that he could survive. By December, the chances of saving him kept shrinking. By the end of December, I didn't think that the chances were better than 25 or 30%, and early in January, they had fallen still more. When it was clear that the Shah was leaving the country, this is something that I mentioned to the president, if the Shah leaves the country and the army is cut adrift, that the army will disintegrate, it will not support Barzagan, there is no way of holding the thing together under those circumstances. My analysis of what was going on in Iran, I think, was quite correct. My ability to appreciate what was going on in the president's head was much less notable. So that, as far as I'm concerned, that was early in January. It may have been 7th or 8th of January. It may have been earlier. What was the place that Carter was going down in?
Guadalupe.
Yes, the Guadalupe meeting. I figured that if he ever left for Guadalupe, it was all over at the time we were going out. And I left that meeting convinced that it was all over. I should say that I, as I ran around from person to person in November and December, attempting to get interest in what I regarded as one of the critical geopolitical developments in the post-World War II development, this being as insignificant in some sense as the shift of China, or almost as significant as the shift of China in 1949, I felt myself more frustrated in Washington than I had at any other time. Now, after I left the president in whatever it was, January 6th or 7th, I had pretty well written it off. I decided that he was going to Guadalupe and that Bashar was coming out, and that the capacity of the Iranian army to stand its ground would immediately disappear, and that the army would disintegrate as a way of keeping all power from going to Khomeini. I mention this because I had been, I think, Brzezinski's principal ally in these debates, but by that time I decided it was all over, and I pretty well withdrew from further discussions of Iranian policy. Brzezinski went on and occasionally kept me informed about his various hopes, which I regarded as quixotic. Once the Shah was gone, the notion that you were going to have some kind of military coalescence that would result in a military overthrow of a military takeover, the Iron Fist, might have been employed in November. There was no Iron Fist to be employed in late January or early February, and Dutch Heiser was not the man to pull it off, and I decided that early in January, as I indicated, was all over. Now, Brzezinski, who was at least more persistent than I, was still attempting some of these schemes a month and a half later.
Now, in terms of your original proposal to send a special representative to Shaw to talk him up, was it your sense that this would be a way to get him to impose Iron Fist strategy, say, in November or early December?
Yeah, as you want to put it in those crude terms, I'll answer very simply, yeah. You say the Shah was doing everything wrong. The Shah was doing everything wrong in that time frame. On Monday, his troops would shoot down some people in the streets, and on Tuesday he would come forward and beg the forgiveness of the populace, and on Wednesday another incident would occur, and this wobbling was conveying to the Iranian public that his authority was really gone, and that you couldn't wobble under those circumstances. You had to have a consistent policy. Now, I was not, mind you, I was not suggesting that the army indiscriminately fire into mobs and that and the like, because that would have been almost as bad as the wobbling policy. But we knew who the ringleaders were in the country. There were 400 or 500 of them. They could have been rounded up, which brings me to the whole discussion of Khomeini and Paris and the like. We could have rounded them up. We could have arranged for the termination of Khomeini's communications with Iran. All of that could have been done. All of that could have been attempted. And it might indeed have been crowned with success, mind you. By this time, I thought that the probability of success had fallen to below 50-50. But it could well have been crowned with success. I should say, in passing, that I never shared the hopes or illusions of several in the administration that Khomeini was going to be, that we would be able to work with Khomeini. He struck me as a fanatic, indeed, strikes me as a fanatic. At one of our meetings, we had an intelligence briefing from Admiral Turner in which he talked about the post-takeover evolution of Khomeini towards moderation, and I told Brzezinski even more forcefully that that was absolutely preposterous, that Khomeini was hopelessly anti-American and hopelessly anti-West, and the notion that this fanatic was going to become a regular politician once in power was misguided. But in any event, what was I on before this?
What the Shah could have done, given you.
Oh yeah, I was talking about the cutting off the communications and rounding up the ringleaders and so on. That there was a great deal of power, and that once you had done this, that there was a very large probability that you would not have been turning out the mobs that were very well organized and the like, that the sole opportunity at that stage of preserving the throne was to take care of the ringleaders. Now, you understand that under circumstances of that sort, with the demonstration of power of that sort, that the Iranian population might have done what it traditionally does, which is decide with the winner, who might well be defined. But that, whether that was right or wrong, that was the notion that I had in my mind. And that the Shah would have to be encouraged, because he was by nature indecisive, and in addition, he was he had perceived the ambivalence of American policy, and that he was not sure that he would be backed up by the United States. That's why you had to have a high-level representative known to be close to the president to bring him to the state. Now, what was wrong with that view? In retrospect, it's plain that the Shah was sufficiently sick that he probably could not have carried it out.
Well, reading Sixth Book, I have the impression that despite his illness, he considered a policy of greater repression after a certain point, but that he thought that the troops weren't loyal enough to carry it out. He was afraid there might be a military rebellion if he had a policy of repression.
This was a continuing concern of mine, because you could see, as you read the daily take from the country, you could see that what had initially been very faithful forces were eroding in their loyalties, that their capacity to deal with the crowd, that there were desertions and so forth, and that the military was a wasting asset, particularly the enlisted personnel. What might have worked in November, when military martial law was first established, or when I wanted somebody to go out there, might very well not have worked at all in December. Now, you could have rounded up the ringleaders, and you could have cut off Khomeini's communications. And if you had done so, the street actions might well have eroded.
Can you analyze revolution basically in terms of ringleaders or more fundamental social problems? How did you analyze it to begin with, I guess?
Well, I think that you can talk about what my analysis was of Iran, or what my analysis is of revolutions, because the revolutionary fervor is more evident in retrospect than it was at the time. My view of revolutions is pretty well summarized by Tocqueville or by Cranford in his Anatomy of Revolution. It is, amongst other things, it is wobbling on the part of the authorities incompetence and wobbling on the part of the authorities that permits the conflagration of revolutionary sentiment to feed on itself. There was no question that the Shah had sufficient instruments of power to do the roundup of these ringleaders. Now you ask, in retrospect, am I convinced that this would have worked? And I said, no. I wasn't even convinced at the time of the work. I thought that we had a chance. I knew that the outcome, if Khomeini took over, was going to be a disaster for the United States. A disaster not only in Iran, but elsewhere in the Middle East, because our stock would fall. And that it was well worth the chance. If I had believed with Admiral Turner and others that Khomeini might turn out to be a moderate with whom we could work, somebody who we could work even though immoderate, then the risks might have been greater than the possible benefits. But I didn't believe that. I thought that it was going to be a dead loss. And while one's analysis of the circumstances may have been wrong in retrospect on the fact that Khomeini was going to be anti-Western and a dead loss from our standpoint, that's turned out to be directly right. Now, with regard to Khomeini was sitting there in a Parisian suburb making use of French telecommunications. He was taping cassettes by the dozen, and that these were being shipped out there, being reproduced by the hundreds, and inflaming the country. that could have been terminated, and that could have been terminated early on.
Were these discussed? These alternatives discussed? You know, the National Security Council?
I was just about to come to that, or about to come to that issue. No, these things weren't really discussed in the National Security Council, because I pointed out to you earlier that there was kind of just a basic division within the administration, which Carter has not resolved, or had not resolved at that point. He was drifting towards the Brzezinski view of the world, but he didn't quite embrace it. And he didn't quite say, we're not going the state's way. If he'd said we're going the state's way, that would have been fine. Well, not fine from my standpoint, but it would have been better administration. But these meetings tended to be polite exchanges, which save on rare occasions in which we had agreed on technical measures, did not bridge the basic analytical differences about what to do, whether you're supporting the Shah or replacing the Shah. The state people tended to take the view that the Shah must go, and they used the Council of Notables, etc. We tended to take the view that the throne must be sustained, and that probably, though not positively, meant that the Shah had to be supported. It certainly meant that you had to arrange a very nice transition to his son taking over, which had certain advantages. So that didn't come up in those discussions. As I mentioned to you, however, I had been to China. And one of the things the Chinese were doing was planning to build a couple of nuclear plants. The nuclear plants were Framatome plants, Framatome being the principal French constructor or vendor of nuclear plants. And they used Westinghouse's design. Secretary of Energy, its successor to the Atomic Energy Commission, would give the authority whether or not those designs could be used for transfer to some third party. So I had a visit shortly after my return from the French ambassador. And we chatted a bit, politely, about China. We made official requests that we look favorably on authorizing Framatome to use Westinghouse's designs. And I said that there shouldn't be much problem about that. I wasn't that much worried about commercial matters and so on. And we seemed much relieved. I said, but there's something of much greater importance, Mr. Ambassador, and that is, you are harboring in Paris the man who is in the process of bringing down the Shah of Iran. Why don't you curb him? Why do you allow him full access to communications? Why do you allow this insurrectionary stuff to go out of France? And he said to me, we have had no request from the Shah to bring extraordinary measures to bear. Indeed, we asked the Shah what he wanted to do, and he said, let him alone. Which stunned me at the time. Shah had so underrated the problem. Shah had been busy kind of making his problem worse, because he had now put him in the center of a center of Western communications. But the Shah had taken no action to still Khomeini's voice. The French government, which was quite capable of taking vigorous action, there's no country that's better at that kind of thing than the French. And a breakdown of French telephonic communications, this year, Khomeini, you know, must know how regretful we are of these developments. The French were perfectly within their rights. The Shah had not made any request. I was stunned by that. If there had been action early on to isolate Khomeini, not to make him a martyr, mind you, but simply to cut off communication, as well as rounding up of the ringleaders, we might well have had a better outcome. Now, academics, liberals of all sorts, more than academics and liberals, express doubt about this. They believe, as your prior question suggested, that these things are uncontrollable once they get started. That is the application of splendid hindsight. And just to underscore these possibilities, let me point out what developed in Poland subsequently. Jaruzelski declared martial law, either rounded up the leaders or drove them underground, took over communications. He effectively cut off solidarity that had the overwhelming support of the Polish people. There is a tendency on the part of many here in the United States to underestimate the power of the instruments of authority and overestimate the zeal and persistency of supposedly mass movements. Quite frequently, when the leaders are taken away, their followers mill around because they're leaderless or just disappear. That has been the prior history in Iran. It certainly was what happened to the Shah as he left. 52 or 53, and when Mossadegh left in 53, bang, the crowd is with the apparent winner. And part of the reason that the Shah was getting into greater and greater trouble was that there were increasing and legitimate doubts that he was a winner.
Solid foreigner.